Welcome. This is Suzanne Toro, and I want to thank you all for joining us today. We have special guest John Lamb Lash. He is an author, a scholar, a Turtan, and the navigator of planetary tantra in correlation with the correction of Sophia. We will dive into a discourse today around the wrathful green Tara with the intention to clear a few matters up, reconnect to our roots, so to speak, and also to maybe embrace the possibility of looking at the truth face on and then exploring Tara and all that she has to offer each and every one of us. With that being said, let's sit back and enjoy our discourse with John Lamb Lash. John, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. Well, I want to thank you for having this conversation with me about Green Tara today. And the reason I wanted to do this, I think, one is to bring awareness to her energy for the upcoming months and maybe years to come. And I wanted just to start with a question about, from your framework and all your knowledge base, if you can share with everyone about Green Tara, what I've read in the literature that's been written, and then I have a different connection with her, is that she was brought to Tibet via Tisa from India, and people have different relationships with her. So I would just like to know your opinion and your where you feel her true origin is from, and what terma that she brought to Tibet.
Well, certainly the numinous presence of Green Tara is truly wonderful, and is truly a frequency and an energy that she is the green, wrathful Green Tara, a deliverance for our species from our insanity, and particularly from the insanity into which we've fallen because of our alienation from nature. I'm looking at the notes you sent, Suzanne, and I would say that perhaps what I can offer in this conversation is an approach to two origins of the Green Tara in Tibet. In my understanding, there are two origins of the Green Tara. One is what you might call the primordial origin, which relates to a very, very long history of our species through various kalpas. And the other is the historical or immediate origin. So I could perhaps address both those origins.
That would be beautiful.
Okay.
Yeah.
The primordial origin of the Green Tara, as I understand it, is this. And now I just want to say that I'm speaking as a Turtan and as a shaman who investigates the prehistory of prehistory. In all cultures, not just the Tibetan, there have been Turtans in many cultures of the world. They've not been called Turtans necessarily. They've been called bards, for instance, in the Celtic culture. They were called bards. What was a bard in the Celtic culture? It was a poet and a shaman who was able to access the phylogenetic memory of the species and thereby able to read the history of the species, the history of the tribe, going back to untold times. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So the role of the Turtan in Tibet has a particular profile, of course, and we would look at the elements of that profile, but it belongs to a generic type, which is the bard, the seer, the tribal guardian of memory. So I speak to you now in that respect as a tribal guardian of the memory of the entire human species. The primordial origin of Green Tara goes back to the last ice age and to the transition from this, the previous kalpa, which ended around 23, 24,000 BC, into the present kalpa. And at the time of the transition of these kalpas, which is timed by the precession of the equinoxes, At the time to which I'm referring, we would direct our attention to the Himalayas and to the caves and recesses that are known to exist in the Himalayan mountains. And we would direct our attention to the so-called rishis of the Vedic and Vedantic traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who were these rishis in the context of this question of green Tara? Well, they were in fact men and women, and they were paired. And that is why the seven rishis who are male are always mysteriously paired with seven female rishis. So when you think of the rishis of ancient India, you always want to think of yogic pairs of the yuganada, or the unity of the male and female. The ancient scenario shows that these rishis were pairs of yogis embraced, if you want to visualize them this way, you can, embraced in that yogic posture of yoga tantra, where they are sitting in the combined lotus, and the man and woman in the sexual lotus unity, mm-hmm. which you see in so many Tibetan icons, okay?
Right.
Visualize them in that way. That is the origin. The origin of the Tibetan icons of the Tibetan deity and his consort in that unity, in that sexual posture of unity, is actually a memory of an action that was taken place in the transition from the last ice age into the present period of time. Certain individuals and couples united in that way. They put themselves into that actual physical posture. It's not just an iconographic device, you know.
Yeah.
They put themselves in that posture and they went into deep tummo, which is heat yoga. And they also went into suspended animation. And so if you picture the caves of the Himalaya 24,000 years ago, you want to picture couples of men and women in suspended animation in a heat envelope buried under enormous masses of snow in the caves of the Himalaya. And that is how they survived through the Ice Age, by putting themselves into yogic suspended animation.
Hmm.
Is that picture clear?
Oh, yeah, very clear for me. Yeah.
Okay. Now, we're talking about the primordial origins of the Green Tara now. I'll get to the historical origins with Atisa in a moment. The primordial origins actually take us back to a moment when the snows began to melt and when the massive glaciers began to withdraw, and when these couples who had taken refuge in various caves in the Himalayas in this yogic posture of unity, in this suspended animation, surrounded by a heat envelope, a tummo envelope, so they could live and survive through those frozen centuries, they revived themselves out of suspended animation. And as they did so, the first thing that they saw was the greening in the foothills of the Himalaya. They saw that it began to be green. As the glaciers melted and slowly withdrew, and as they came out of their yogic state of suspended animation, which they maintained by this yabyu, they looked down from the entrances of their caves, down the long, long valleys, and they saw that the earth was becoming green. The ice age was ending, and they could come out of the suspended animation that they had been in since the ice age occurred. And they understood this greening of the earth to be the green Tara. Now, you know that Tara means deliverance. And so they said, this is our deliverance. Look, it's green. There's grass growing on the border of the glaciers. There are trees sprouting. The seas that have been held in suspension by the mother Gaia are sprouting. The world is becoming green, and we are delivered. We are delivered from our state of yogic suspended animation. We can now step out, and we can start to relive life in this new environment. That is what originally deliverance meant. The deliverance of Tara. The greening of Tara, if you will.
Yeah.
That is the primordial origin of Tara. It's an actual event that occurred at the end of the last ice age. Okay?
I'm with you.
Now, it was a natural consequence of this awakening that they then saw, the people of the Himalaya, then saw in the mountains and in the valleys of the Himalayas, they saw the presence of this Tara being, the green Tara, meaning the greening, the recapturing of life and of vegetation after the end of the Ice Age. That is the ultimate meaning, the primordial meaning of the green Tara. And they saw her as a divine lady, and they pictured the benevolence of nature and of the plant world, especially to feed them, the process of making chlorophyll. They saw this welcoming them back to a new kalpa of life, a new cycle of precession of 26,000 years. They saw it delivering them from their state of suspended animation and welcoming them back to life and to eating and to food and to photosynthesis. And in the inspiration of that moment, in their gratitude for Mother Earth for resuscitating them, they visualized her in bone religion as a particular divine feminine deity. She was called the auspicious lady or the noble one of long life. And she was called that because she is the one who resurrects those who go into the yogic suspended animation at the end of every kalpa when the ice comes down. She is the noble one of long life. She's the resurrecting power of the greening of the earth. And the Tibetan name they gave to her was Zangsa Ringtsun. And you will still find this name preserved in Bon Po religion. Zangsa Ringtsun. Zangsa Ringtsun. And she was a lady of the mountains. She was pictured as a living mountain. And out of her breasts and out of the mountainous forms of her body, out of the mountainous form of her torso, of her mons veneris, they were reborn into a new cycle of life, which is the cycle of life that we are now currently finishing.
Right.
So that is the primordial origin. Green Tara was known in Bon religion as Zangsa Ringtsun.
Well said. Thank you.
So that's the primordial origin. So she was there in the mountains, in the topography of the Himalayas, and in the areas that border on the fertile areas that border on the glaciers. That is the body of the green Tara, if you want to consider her in a primordial sense. Now let's shift to, you know, what was she historically speaking? You know, in your notes, you cite Atisa, and you point out the view held by many historians that green Tara, or her equivalent, was brought into Tibet by a Tisa, who was an Indian yogi at a certain point. I don't know, when was that, 7th, 8th century?
Earlier than that.
Mm-hmm. Earlier than that, that's right. So what does this mean? I mean, how could she have been brought there when she was already there?
Right. What does that mean,
how
John?
Do you reckon
that? To me it means there was a lock created on something at that point in time.
No, it's not a lock, Suzanne. It's just oblivion.
Okay.
It's amnesia. Don't call it a lock.
Okay.
Don't attribute to it more than it is. It's just amnesia.
Okay.
Amnesia. So what happened was that even though the green Tara was embodied in the landscape of Tibet, and she still is today, particularly in the rhododendron, that grows in great abundance in the foothills of the Himalaya, the rhododendron, it's her plant. Even though she was always present there, because she represented the greening of the earth after the last ice age, people forgot that. They forgot that. They continued to live. They took up life. And as often happens in this world, as typically happens with human beings, we're so busy and occupied with the events of life that we forget the sublime underpinning of life.
Mm-hmm.
So they forgot who she was. And it wasn't until Atisa brought, who was a monk from India, an Indian yogi, Anatta yogi, brought her identity back into their memory by bringing certain iconographical images of her and certain tantric practices invoking Tara into Tibet at the time that Atisa arrived. And I can't really exactly determine when that was, but it was before Padmasambhava arrived.
Yeah.
Which was in the 8th century. Okay.
Memory jogged. That purpose in that moment when the jog occurred, or the ignition occurred, what do you feel it is? I was just reading actually before we got on the call that when he was coming, he was not actually allowed to preach the Diamond Vehicle, which we've had a little bit of remote discourse, because they felt there was a demon in the heart of Tibet.
Right. Well, the situation in Tibet, I like to call Tibet in the, like in the 7th and 8th centuries, leading up to the moment when Padmasambhava arrives, and we'll get to him in a moment. And that'll be something that's never been said before.
Yay.
When we get to him, I like to think of that as like the American frontier.
Mm.
Tibet was like the Wild West, the American frontier. It was Dodge City. Lhasa, which of course didn't exist as Lhasa, but Lhasa was Dodge City. What do I mean by that? What I mean is there were rumors flying all over southern India. You know, one thing you have to understand about yogis, and you really need to read above any other book, if you want to read a book that gets you into this, if you want to read David Gordon White, The Alchemical Body. And this is about the so-called Siddha traditions of medieval India. Now, the Siddha, he also wrote, by the way, a book which has a most delicious title, Kiss of the Yogini. So if you want to read David Gordon White, he's the only scholar walking around on this planet, if he's still alive, who'll give you any clue to what was really happening at these times. Okay?
Yep.
If you want to get your clues from scholars. And what he shows, what his work shows, is that the world of the Indian yogis and the so-called Nat, N-A-T-H, the Nat Siddhas and the Vajradharas, was a world of magic and sorcery. And it was a world of, very similar to the American West, gunfight at the OK Corral, Dodge City, and all these things. But they weren't using six guns. they were using occult powers.
Hmm.
And the reason why yogis from like Atisha went from the south of the subcontinent of India to Tibet was to engage in gunfights, the equivalent of gunfights and magical battles, because that's what it was all about. Because these yogis are not siddhas. These siddha means an accomplished yogi, got their kicks out of challenging other yogis with their occult powers.
Mm.
So the reason why Atisha went to Tibet was not to, you know, propagate some sublime doctrine or teach enlightenment or anything. Atisha went there in order to engage in challenges and duels with the other yogis who were in Tibet. Mm. And Tibet had a reputation at that time. It had a reputation for a very long time. And the reputation was that there were sorcerers and very powerful shamans in Tibet, and they were dangerous and wild people. And wouldn't you like to go up there and see if you can duel with one of them?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why Atisha went to Tibet. There's nothing sublime about some teaching he was carrying or some mysterious, you know, message of enlightenment. This is not about enlightenment. Tantra is not about enlightenment. Do you know that?
I do know that. That's why I'm having you share this discourse.
Power.
Yes.
Yeah, it's about power.
Yeah.
It's about playing with power. It's not about enlightenment. Enlightenment, you know, you can have it or not have it. But power is the game.
Yeah.
And it was the games of power that these people were playing. And so what happened was that Atisha was a southern Indian yogi, or an Indian yogi, not too southern. I don't know if he was initiated in the Dravidian tradition, which is the profound goddess religion of southern India. But he was like, went to Tibet and said, like, it's like, you know, Jesse James going to Dodge City to have a gunfight with someone to see who can draw the fastest.
Yep.
This is what it was about.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so he brought to Tibet certain understanding which came out of southern India and out of the aboriginal regions of the oceanic part of this planet, of another understanding of Tara, of the greening or the vegetation power of the earth. And he brought it to Tibet, and we have a very superficial and stilted story of how all that happened from scholars. They don't have a clue to what really happened.
Right. Hmm.
So, let's go on with your question. I listed in the notes you sent me. What is the Dharma she delivered to Tibet?
Yep.
He delivered? I don't have the faintest idea. I wasn't there when that story was made up.
Right.
Okay?
Feels like none.
That's right.
Feels like none. So, with that being said, her energy and maybe the purpose was to reconnect or bring back memory. What do you feel the purpose in that moment, and what do you feel those participating in that moment in Tibet as the Tantra practices got reinstated on many levels was for, and how did it really form the reality that we're living in now, and also under certain levels of deception?
Well, Suzanne, I'm not exactly sure where you're going with that question. Can you be a little more precise?
Well, if we're going through, you know, a process and memory has to be restored, because maybe that was a point in space that we needed to start to remember Tara, the primordial Tara. However, maybe it was depicted in these romanticized stories of being a sorcerer / an enlightened yogi that's going to, you know, go off into nirvana. What do you feel at that point in time? Because that would definitely be what I would call some kind of a connect / disconnect that occurred in history with her. And where did that's led us to now? And yeah, what do you feel at that moment in time was being resurrected so that she could maybe serve at this next transition?
Okay, I sort of get a sense of where you're going. The controversy that occurred in Tibet at the time of Atisa, and later on at the time of a certain individual who has been called Padmasambhava, but that's not his true name, not his actual name. The controversy that was raging in Tibet in the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries of the historical era was about one single subject, which is the use of psychoactive plants. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but it makes perfect sense.
That's right. The yogis, there was a yogic tradition in, by the way, I would refer you to an article which you can find on the internet, if it hasn't been taken down. This is an extremely important article. It's a brief article. It's called Psychoactive Plants in Tantric Buddhism. And it's accredited to R. C. Parker, R. period C. period Parker, and Lux, L-U-X. And you used to be able to find it in the Arrowhead extracts. Arrowhead is an internet resource for information on entheogenic and psychedelic plants. E-R-O-W-I-D. And it was number 14 in the Arrowhead extracts of June 2008. I don't know if it's still up there because the person who wrote it, I think, was a little dodgy about it. Anyway, the controversy was, are we going to practice certain forms of yoga that lead to enlightenment and a kind of disembodied enlightenment, which came to be called nirvana, which is a disembodied enlightenment? We don't want nirvana today because in my practice anyway, I don't want it because it's a disembodied enlightenment. But there was a big plea for a disembodied enlightenment among the Indian yogis and the Tibetan yogis for many centuries. But then there came out of the south another brand of yogi, you know, another brand of six-gun shaman with occult powers saying, hey, man, I'm shooting in a different manner here. I'm not interested in disembodied enlightenment. I'm interested in the embodiment of occult powers, siddhis, that can be acquired through the use of psychoactive plants. And this was a huge controversy. And the center of this controversy was an individual called Padmasambhava. That was not his actual name. And so this is what it was about. And what does this have to do with green Tara? It has a lot to do with green Tara. Because green Tara, let's go back to her primordial profile, represents the greening and revegetation of the earth after an ice age. Okay?
Yeah.
She is called Deliverance and she is called the Bridge. You know these traditional titles, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because she is the bridge from a period of glaciation into a period where things begin to grow again. And among those things that begin to grow are the psychoactive plants given to us by Gaia to elevate our consciousness and lift us into paranormal states. So there were some yogis who were in favor of these psychoactive plants and some yogis who weren't. And this is what the whole controversy around Tara was about in Tibet in those centuries.
So, seems like a continual theme that we've had throughout history.
Yeah, we've had that question. That is a really important question. But in Western history, unfortunately, we don't have very much of a chance of even considering the use of psychoactive plants and sacred medicine plants for spiritual development, do we? I mean, it's absolutely and utterly condemned, isn't it? It's condemned from the moment it's mentioned.
Correct.
It's condemned, you know, to witchcraft and sorcery, and, you know. But that wasn't the way in Tibet and India in these centuries. And they had a huge debate over this. And the central figure in this debate was the individual who has been named by the Tibetan Buddhists, Padmasambhava.
And his real name?
Well, I don't know his real name, Suzanne, but I know the name that he assumed as a Vajradhara, or carrier of the Vajra power. Mm. And that name was Shakyanata. Shakyanata. He called himself Shakyanata. The actual historical entity to whom Tibetans refer, and which is who is the highest entity, you know, precious guru, precious Rinpoche of Tibetan Buddhism, was actually a Sisian. He was the son of a family of Scythian merchants. Scythians. You know who the Scythians were?
No.
S-C-Y-T-H-I-A-N. The Scythians were a tribal people of the steppes of Russia.
Mm.
And they were a culture that existed in the post-Christian centuries along the areas of the Near East and Far East, extending into India. And I want to get this name right. I don't mislead anyone. Person whom the Tibetans call Padmasambhava, which means the lotus-born, they have concocted a huge set of ridiculous fairy tales around the life of this person, which are completely absurd. They have made this person appear to be like a Jesus figure of some kind of virgin birth. He was lotus born, and he had a miraculous this, and he had a miraculous that. That's all a bunch of crap. It's total crap that they use to wrap up their system of Tibetan Buddhism into a mystique that they can use to sell themselves to people as parasites.
Mm.
Because they don't do anything and they don't really offer anything. What do they offer? Have you ever met a Tibetan master of any kind who actually does anything like making a good tuna fish sandwich?
I haven't had a Tibetan master make me a tuna fish sandwich. Absolutely not.
Well, ask them to make you a tuna fish sandwich.
I will.
And not only that, Suzanne, ask them to go out to the fucking supermarket and stand in line like every other jerk and buy the ingredients of the tuna fish sandwich and pay for it out of money that they earned out of their own pocket.
Hmm. Yeah.
They're parasites, and they have created a system of mystification and fairy tale bullshit. And I am absolutely fed up with these people. And I'm going to tell you what is the real story behind the front that they have been perpetuating.
Let's do it.
Padmasambhava was the son of merchants born in a town called Akshayana. And this is a town in the region of the Amu Darya River that flows along the border of Afghanistan and Tajikistan today. Akshayana was the birthplace of this individual. I don't know what his name was, but he was a Scythian. That is to say, he was of the warrior class of the Russian steppes. And he was also of the merchant class, because his father was a merchant. And this young man, do you ever wonder why Padmasambhava has a mustache?
No, but I've noticed it quite intensely at times.
Isn't it rather remarkable?
Yeah.
That Padmasambhava has a mustache.
Yeah.
It's a very well cultivated mustache.
Definitely.
You know? It's a very fine mustache, isn't it?
Very fancy.
It's very fancy and it's very groomed, isn't it?
Yep.
Well, that's the whole secret to the identity of who he is. Because that kind of mustache, the Dali mustache, that I call it, because Salvador Dali used to have a mustache like that, is the signature of the class, a certain class of Scythian warriors.
Mm.
And that is a remarkable fact that no Tibetan themselves today, right up to the Dalai Lama, would even know.
Hmm.
Because they don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Hmm.
They have lost their origins and they have lost the plot.
Yeah.
So what happened was that this young man was very, very gifted with psychic powers, and he was also extremely aggressive. And he learned the martial arts at an early age. He traveled along the Silk Route. He was an adventurer. He ran away from home. from his mercantile background, and he was basically a Scythian of a strong warrior temperament. And he ended up learning the ways of the yogis and the Nath Siddhas of India, as White calls them, David Gordon White.
Mm-hmm.
And he merged these natural tendencies he had to be a warrior, which came from his Scythian background. The Scythians come from the Russian steppes. Okay? He merged it with the path of the yogi and the path of magic and of magical attainments. And so he became, at a very early age, when he was in his early 20s actually, a notorious equivalent to like a gunslinger. But he was like a yogi. So he wasn't wearing six guns. He was carrying these yogic powers, these siddhis. And he traveled down into the depths of India and met many other yogis and conversed with them and exchanged secrets with them. Didn't really battle with many of them, but he was known as being a dangerous person. He called himself, when he got to India, he adopted the name Sakyanatha. S-A-K-Y-A-N-A-T-H-A. He adopted the name Sakyanatha. And he did that for a very special reason, because Sakya is the clan of the historical Buddha. You know that?
Yeah,
that was his family. He was of the family of Sakya. And he was called Sakyamuni, which means the sage of the Sakyas. You know?
Mm.
So when he got down to southern India, he was from Oxiana, which is in the area of Afghanistan. When he got down to southern India, I was very drawn to southern India because someone told him, and it's absolutely fucking true, that the deepest secrets of sexual and magical power were known to the Dravidian cults of southern India in Tamil Nadu, which is the southern part of the Indian subcontinent. So he wandered down there saying, I want to know all the deepest secrets, and I also want to get on to some of these hot women down here because they're outrageously beautiful, and they're all different colors of black and purple, and they're known to have incredible tantric secrets.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to southern India, to the land of the Dravidians, seeking a sexual initiation, and he found it. He found it big time. And when he found it, he also understood who Tara really was, especially the wrathful Tara. So he received the secret Shakyanatha, who named himself after the Buddha of India, but he gave it a certain twist. You see, he named himself Shakya, after the Buddha of India, but Nata. A Nata is a very hardcore yogi who practices magical and occult powers. So he named himself that, and he said, I am Shakyanata, and I have come to Dravidia. I have come to the land of Tamil Nadu because I want to be initiated by one of these outrageous goddesses of the Devi, because they have magical powers that no one else has. And he acquired these powers, and he acquired his own kind of Tara initiation. And that is what took him back to Tibet. That is what eventually led him back to Tibet. Not back to, but that was what led him into Tibet from southern India.
Mm.
So he was born in Oxiana, in Afghanistan. He traveled to southern India, was initiated there, and then he decided to take a mission to go to Dodge City, which is equivalent of Lhasa, and test his occult powers against the notorious shamans and sorcerers of Tibet.
Mm.
This is the real story.
Mm.
The rest of it is bullshit fairy tale that these Tibetan Buddhists are selling to people, and they're selling it. They're parasites. They have nothing to offer. They have no real magic. You tell me, you give me any example of any Tibetan master in the last 20 years who have shown any magic, real magic at all.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me.
I can't tell you of one that I've encountered.
Suzanne, because you frequent these people.
Yeah, no.
And I have to ask myself, what are you doing with these people?
Well,
excuse me for being presumptuous.
Yeah, you have right to ask. You know, I'm on a reconnaissance mission, I guess. Recovery.
All right. Okay.
And you're helping sharing the truth.
I'll accept that.
Yeah.
Okay. Reconnaissance.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me ask you something, dear woman.
Yeah.
What would you say in your role as a reconnaissance agent about the Dalai Lama going to fucking Washington, D.C. and performing the Kala Chakra ceremony? For what? For whom? Why?
Well, I can't answer for him as to why at all. It would, in my mind, be inappropriate for many reasons. And I'm about the goddess and allowing her to be released for all intents and purposes. I don't know the best syntax to share that with you with. I'm always careful with my words, but... Yes, I understand. There's been a lot of puppet shows going on with the, we'll call them the CIA and the Black Ops and the entities.
Yeah, and Vajrayana and Tibetan Buddhism. Throw them into the law.
Yeah, of course. Let
me say this, before, and I'm going to calm myself down, but I have one more thing to say.
No, keep going.
The Dalai Lama has no fucking business going to Washington, D.C., which is the heart of the nest of the planetary predators and psychopaths.
Right.
And performing a tantric ceremony, if not to destroy them all and burn them alive. And he didn't do that. What is the point? You know, this is absolutely ridiculous. This has to stop. These old farts do not have a monopoly on the goddess wisdom and on the magic of the goddess. And this has to stop.
I agree.
Right now.
I agree. I think that's why I completely agree, because there's no reason for it. And
no.
So
it's gone on too long, Suzanne.
Right.
You know? Right. So you want to know about the Raffle Green Tara?
Well, I want you to share more, because this is really important, because people are misled down roads. And, you know, for me personally, in my memory bank to carry... you know, the manipulation that occurred, and then somehow to have at some point in time inadvertently participated in it doesn't feel great. And so that's my interest in releasing that energy and not allowing those beings to hold that energy, because it's not to be used in that way. So, go into Wrathful Tara.
First, let me say this. You don't have to release nothing. Money. It is released.
Right.
It is released. The way to release it is do not pay reverence to these dried up old dudes. Okay?
Do you feel, though, I understand and I hear you, do you feel, though, however, there's knowing, you know, being a shaman and knowing that, you know, how magic works, that there's ability to lock things in. And
no ability. They're powerless old farts. I'll tell you right now, there is more tantric power in a 16-year-old black girl from Baltimore than there is in the Dalai Lama.
Right, but what about the collective memories?
The collective memories don't count for nothing. They're falling apart. They're being destroyed and obliterated by the absolute escalation of our insanity. You know? The insanity of the human race is escalating us to a place where we're going to hit the wall. And when we hit that wall, as far as I'm concerned, I already hit it. You know, I hit the wall. But when humanity as a whole hits that wall, two things happen. All these pretensions and all these old claims to hold this power and to lock up the magic disintegrate in an instant. And the opportunity for the true magic blossoms in the heart and mind of every single person who can receive it.
Right. Perfect.
This is our moment.
Yeah.
This is our moment. So forget it. They have no power. They're powerless. They're impotent. And the only power they get is from, you know, excuse me for being vulgar, but, you know,
it's okay,
conjuring
John.
On the menstrual fluids of some virgin girl, you know.
Right.
And they don't even know how to do that. Okay?
Yep.
So they don't have any real magical power, Suzanne. They don't. They're fraudulent.
No, and I understand. Yeah, I'm not trying to give them power. It's more removing the veil for the people that are under, you know, the guise of something that is not. That's more than saying that they have power.
I understand your viewpoint, and I try to calm myself down and be a little bit compassionate about it. Okay.
People
have to understand that the people are not going to get the magic, Suzanne, unless they get it directly from the source.
Right.
So when they realize that they're not getting it from these tulkus and rinpoches and karmapas, when they realize that they're getting ripped off and they're not getting it from these characters, they might then, one person at a time, realize that they have to get it from elsewhere.
Right.
And that is what the wrathful Tara will show them. The wrathful Tara, who is angry because we have denied the true source of magic in the divine feminine.
Right.
That's what she's angry about. No man can mediate for the divine feminine, my friend. No institution, no matter how sublime and revered, can mediate between humanity and the divine feminine. It is a direct impact. And that is what every single person has to get in their own way, Suzanne. So there's no real way that we can lift the veil for the collective. We can only point to where the true magic and the true energy are located.
Well, let's do that then.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. I really appreciate you, John.
Well, I you as well. I've never met you, but you know, there's something between us, Suzanne, and there's a respect and there's a resonance and there's playfulness and there's wisdom between us.
Yeah.
Wisdom.
Yeah, so Rathful Tara is ready.
She is absolutely ready. She's ready to tear away the veils.
Yeah.
She's ready to blow the doors off the Potala.
Hmm.
This is over. The game is already over. Don't need John Lash to announce it. Over. Yeah.
Lead the watchful eye over to Tara, so those listening that might have their jaws dropping right now can maybe sit with the wrath of Tara.
That's right. Sit with the wrath of Tara and understand that the divine Sophia, the living intelligence of this planet, the divinity that supports every breath you breathe right now, and that infuses your cells with life, she herself is angry. Tara and Kali are the anger of Sophia. And why is she angry? Why is the earth angry? She's angry because we have forgotten that she is our nurturer. She is our nurturer and our nourishment and our origin. And she is not only our natural nurturer, that is to say, we eat the plants of the earth, we live by the oxygen, we live by the substances produced by photosynthesis, by the miracle of the symbiosis of nature and the endosymbiosis, as Lynn Margulis called it. But she's also angry because we did not recognize that she gave us the psychoactive plants to cure our insanity. This is what the great debate in Atissa's time was about, and in the time of Shakyanata. The great psychoactive plants that Gaia gave us because she knew we would go insane. And she knew that the only thing that would bring us back to sanity most reliably would be the ingestion of these plants, of these gifts of the green world. That's what she's angry about, that we've turned our back on that, that we've made it illegal, that we've demonized the very gifts she gave us to restore us to sanity. And she is very, very angry about that.
Ooh, and I feel that one. Okay, so keep going, John, as to where we can connect the dots.
Well, the way to realign with the divine Sophia and with the modalities of her beauty and wisdom, which are represented by these Shakti beings, these Mahavidyas, these images of Tibetan iconography, The way that we realign with that is immediate and imminent and concrete. If we respect her wrath, the wrath of the planetary mother, that we have turned away from her graciousness and her benevolence, how do we turn back toward it? This is a big question. First of all, you have to have a real longing in your heart to want to do that. You understand that this is not an abstract or metaphysical practice.
Right.
This is an imminent emotional engagement. How do we turn back to her? You have to have the longing in your heart. You have to have the desire to reach again into her beauty and be embraced by her beauty and her power. And the way you do that is by following her moods. Her moods. The Dakinis are her moods. This is the great secret of planetary tantra. The Dakinis are her moods. So follow her moods. Learn to be in her moods when she is in those moods. And this is what can be done in planetary tantra through the observation of the lunar cycles and the Dakini frequencies that correspond to each of these cycles. So there is a real practice that gets us back to her and integrates her again, integrates us again into her beauty and her wisdom.
Mm. And how do you feel that wrath is going to escalate in these next coming weeks or months for all of us?
Good question there. Good question there, Suzanne. I want to point out something about this term wrath. It's a very, very important term in planetary tantra, and certainly also an extremely important and significant term in Tibetan Buddhism, obviously. Mm. Because, you know, anyone who gets into Tibetan Buddhism, one of the first things you learn is about the so-called, you know, wrathful deities.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it is said that you will experience at death a vision of the mandala of the peaceful deities, and you will experience the wrathful deities. And it is said in the Tibetan Book of the Dead that this is the universal and generic experience of the bardo, of the transition from one life to another. And every human being will undergo this experience. Wrath means many, many things. It's a profoundly resonant term in our spirituality, in our indigenous spirituality. But one of the things that wrath means is it means that you make sudden choice, you know? It means that if you're in wrath, it means that you're in a state of panic, as it were. And in that state of panic or wrath, which comes to you from the supernatural powers, you are directed to a brutal choice. You must make a choice. So wrathfulness is about making a radical choice. The wrathful Green Tara stands before each one of us. She's beautiful. She's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at her. She's green, surrounded by leafy forms, by beautiful, harmonious, fractal energies of nature.
Mm-hmm.
But she demands that you make a radical choice. She puts you into a state of panic. And she says, listen, you either choose to be part of, quote, civilization, unquote, and therefore be part of the mechanized world and the electronic world and the computerized world and that whole realm of mechanical electronic behavior, or you choose to be a child of nature, a simple, innocent, but all-powerful child of nature. This is wrathfulness. Wrathfulness is a state of absolute panic where you find yourself in a life or death choice.
Hmm.
And this is what humanity is being brought to now. I don't have to elaborate it on, Suzanne. I'm sure you can name many examples. Look at what's happening with the food supply, for instance. I was just listening today to a little bit of YouTube, blah, 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 about the insanity of Monsanto, you know, and the terminal seeds and the trademarking and patenting of the very processes of life itself.
Right.
You know, the predators and the pathological maniacs on this planet are trying to take over the very processes of life itself. And so Tara stands before you and she says, okay, are you going to buy their game? Are you going to play by their rules, by the Monsanto rules of nature, whereby nature can be patented and sold by human beings for their profit? Or are you going to return to the raw power of nature and to your connection with me, with the planet? You see, it's a very brutal and radical choice that we face. This is what wrathfulness means, being placed before a radical choice. I hope I'm expressing that well, because I've never tried to say this before in these exact terms.
You're doing beautiful, beautiful. Yeah.
And that is really the essence of it, you know, and there's so many ways to say it, Suzanne. There's so many ways to say it, and perhaps there are too many ways to say it, because in a way it becomes like a cliche to us.
Right.
Oh, yeah, you know, we don't want GMO foods, we want natural foods. But we got to look at what that choice really entails.
Right.
Oh, my goddess, what that choice entails.
Yeah.
You see? It entails a whole way of life, doesn't it?
Yep.
It entails a whole path of consciousness, you know. It's like, it is so crucial right now that we understand the terms of this choice. And that is why I call the Wrathful Green Tara the Selector.
Mm.
I call her the Selector because she will select you depending on how you stand before this choice. And if she deselects you, you become rubble in Kali's cremation ground.
Mm.
And there is nothing to you and nothing to your life. And you are a worthless person. But if you choose to unite your destiny with the earth and with all that lives and with all that is truly green, the growing part of life, not the cancerous decaying part, then you will have a future life with the goddess.
Hmm. Well said. With her wrathfulness supporting those choices, or offering those choices to all of us in this moment, as the powers that were continue to disintegrate, as I would call it, what is being afforded for everyone when we remove the fear and that magic that is held within this space of the feminine, within the yoni, of, as you refer to it as love, magic, and war. I kind of rephrase it to protection, because war seems, but maybe I shouldn't be so attached to that, what that word means. Can you share a little bit with the listener about that?
Sure. You're right on track, Suzanne. Your intuitions are excellent. We need protection. We really do. We need protection from the psychopaths and the predators on this planet. Every simple and decent and well-intentioned human being who only wants to live in peaceful coexistence needs protection, because we're living on a planet with a small number of people who don't want us to get along, who don't want us to live in mutual aid and coexistence. And so it is a dangerous situation today. It's very, very dangerous. We're in an extremely dangerous moment in the life of our species. I'm elucidating this to the best of my ability in my talks about the Gaian navigation experiment and so forth and so on. But to get back to your point, Suzanne, protection is something that comes from the earth. We need protection, and we need, at the same time, the warrior spirit that allows us to say, I'm willing to live, to risk my life, you know, willing to risk my life. Whatever's worth doing is worth dying for. Whatever's worth living for is worth dying for. This is the moment. I mean, this is a very, very critical moment. And so I would say that I would bring all of you to a consideration of the shift of the Dakinis that occurs in the springtime. And that is the shift that occurs coming up. Let me see if I can tell you when it is. When the crescent moon at sunset appears in the constellation of the Bull. Now, this is a really, really key moment, because this is a moment when two Dakinis come on shift. That is to say, it is the moment when two particular energies of the divine Sophia come forth imminently into, they erupt into the human psyche. And this moment, in the spring of each year, generally in late April or sometime in May, is a moment when two things are critically balanced for us. Coming up in the year 2012, and I can tell you that it will be so, so critical this year, because the year 2012 is I think we all are beginning to understand, a year of a tremendous culmination of many events in our behavior. Much of the pathology and sickness of our behavior has to end, yet at the same time, the beauty of a new behavior can emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And the balance that we want to seek at this moment of the crescent moon in the constellation of the Bull, which is the end of April, the beginning of May, is the balance between protection and selection, which is Tara, and beauty, which is Bhudevi. Bhudevi. Bhudevi is a Hindu tantric name for the goddess of the earth as the spirit of absolute abundance and beauty. This is what we absolutely need to survive, Suzanne. We need, on one hand, our protection and our selection. And on the other hand, we need to live in beauty, because that is her way.
Mm.
And when we have these both, I believe, honestly, I am totally convinced that we have the greatest assurance that we can actually survive this moment of epic insanity that we're now entering.
Mm. Beautiful. Knowing that we've just almost gone over an hour.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we can keep going if you want. And then I was just having kind of a recollection that what's occurring right now is awakening those that connect and resonate them with releasing them from their amnesia.
That's right. Oh, so beautifully said.
Yeah.
This is absolutely crucial. Release from amnesia.
Yeah.
That is absolutely crucial right now. Absolutely. Amnesia, especially, Suzanne, we've forgotten who we are.
Yeah.
You know? We've forgotten that we are the beautiful and innocent child of the mother, children of the mother goddess of this planet. And that's all we have to be.
Mm. So would you be open to a second discourse contextualizing and potentially imagining this beautiful intersection of Tara and Bhudevi and how their play together works and complements each other?
Certainly. I would be delighted. And I am most grateful for you for offering that opportunity. So let's do that. Let's do it in the correct timing. And let's concentrate exactly on that balance between the protection and selection of Tara and the beauty and abundance of Bhudevi, which comes in the springtime with the moods of the Shakti cluster and the moods of the lunar Shaktis as we follow them in planetary Tantra. I would be delighted. Thank you very much for asking.
Yeah, I would likewise. Thank you for accepting. So what we'll do, well, I can do that on the outro unless you want to say where people can connect with you. It's up to you. Do you like to do that?
Well, people can connect with me right now by us. Thank you. If I might say, how can people connect with me? Just write me. I mean, I'm totally accessible, you know. I mean, write me at jll@metahistory.org. And there is a website that is currently under construction, an internet platform for those who want to follow the Gaia Navigation Experiment, that is to say to pursue these practices and visionary techniques of planetary Tantra, and that is called GaiaSpora.org, GaiaSpora.org. So either of those places you can easily reach me.
Yeah, I like that spora.
But I diaspora. Yeah, I like diaspora.
Yeah.
It's pronounced diaspora, I suppose. But diaspora meaning the pollen of the future of those who are in the embrace of the divine planetary mother, Gaia. So I really enjoy this presence with you. You know, you and I don't talk that much. I think people listening to this should understand that I don't know you at all, and you don't know me, but we have something between us. We have wisdom between us and beauty.
Definitely.
And I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, I'm grateful for you and all your work you've done, so thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Once again, John, thank you for sharing your wisdom, showing up, and navigating the ship. Until next time, if you have any feedback, questions, or something you'd like to share, please feel free to email me at s@suzannetoro.com. That's SuzannetoRo.com. Until then, let's just sit back and enjoy one beautiful goddess, Elisaveta, and the song Night Flyers.